tracking and satellite data to analyze how changing ice conditions affect pregnant caribou during their spring migration to their calving grounds.
So they're rushing to the destination to give birth to the young calves.
They need to cross many lakes and rivers, which freeze during the winter.
So if the ice is solid enough, they can directly walk on the ice surface.
But in some areas, ice is melting earlier than it used to, so the animals are forced to choose, swim across the water, which can be dangerous, or walk around it, which makes the journey longer. Liao says if it takes too long, they may not arrive at the calving grounds in time to give birth. So studying how they respond will help determine how global warming is affecting the well-being of these iconic animals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Today on Wings.
It gave people a new way to look at the kind of repetitive work that people think is brainless and easy and is often done by women, and to think about the abilities and skills that are required and the physical demands that may be invisible.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Professor Karen Messing from the University of Quebec at Montreal.
It's really, in a sense, the social questions that make it difficult to be more healthy.
Karen Messing is a biologist and an ergonomist with a special interest in factors affecting women at work. Messing works in a research partnership with three Quebec unions to come up with ways of improving women workers' health. She edited the handbook on integrating gender in ergonomic analysis, published by the Technical Bureau of the European Trade Union Confederation. One of her works in English is the book One-Eyed Science, Occupation, Health, and Working Women, published by Temple University Press.
I'm a biologist by training, and then I got retraining in ergonomics a bit later in my career as a result of meeting a bunch of women cleaners who told me how tough their jobs were and asked me if a university professor couldn't do something about that.
Well, that's an intriguing story to start with. Were you able to do anything about how hard it is to do a cleaning job?
That is a simple question with a very complicated answer. The short answer is only minor things in terms of reducing the number of waste baskets they might have to pick up in a day, and suggesting that the bags that you put inside the waste baskets might fit inside the waste baskets a bit better, so they wouldn't have to make little flipping movements with their wrist 147 times a day. That's an actual count. So little things we were able to change. And then the major effort we were doing was to try to get what's called light work cleaning, which is a shorthand way of saying women's work in cleaning, recognized as being as difficult as heavy work in cleaning, which is another way of saying men's work in cleaning. And that effort was difficult. And also getting cleaning in general acknowledged to be a really important profession and a valuable profession, particularly in a health context where having things clean is an important hedge against infections. So we work at the both the level of the physical demands of the task and also at a more social level. And when we work at a social level, we work in partnership with the three major Quebec trade unions and with their women's committees and health and safety committees.
So if not too much can be done at the physical level, because cleaning involves a lot of different kinds of movements and putting pressure, I guess, and many kinds of things that you have to do with your body that really tire you out. Mm-hmm. But what about this thing about pressures at the social level? I mean, is this actually part of ergonomics?
There's two things. One is that the reason we can't do a lot about the physical requirements of cleaning tasks really has little to do with the intrinsic technical difficulties involved and a lot to do with the social difficulties, in the sense that there are very few employers who think that cleaning is as important as what they perceive to be the major activity of their establishment. For example, in hospitals, they see their job as delivery of medical cures rather than keeping the place clean, which is ancillary to doing the cures. In a factory, cleaning up the factory is less important than producing the widgets, so that cleaning never has a very good position in the hierarchy. And often the cleaners' offices are down in the basement where you'd never see them, and cleaners are not consulted when it's time to design the workspace or buy the furniture. So you see such weird things as people putting mirrors up on way high on the walls, thinking that they look pretty and not thinking that somebody's going to have to clean them way up there and how hard it is to clean mirrors. So it's really, in a sense, the social questions that make it difficult to transfer cleaning work so as to be more healthy. Why it's the task of an ergonomist to work on those kinds of determinants is that we in Quebec do a kind of ergonomics that's called sometimes Francophone ergonomics or ergonomics from French-speaking countries, and it was developed in France, and it recognizes that there are all kinds of causes of the physical difficulties people can have or of the organizational difficulties that people can have, and that you have to work at all levels to both to understand them and to change them.
Wow. So how long has this Francophone ergonomics existed, and has it had an impact on any of the Francophone societies that you can observe?
There's always a social dynamic within science. In France, the Francophone ergonomics in the tradition that we're following started in the 1960s with a professor called Alain Vissinat, who was at a trade school, upper-level trade school in Paris. And he teamed up with a woman named Catherine Tégère and a man named Antoine Laville, and they developed this field. And at the time, they had close alliances with the union movement in France, and they were able to do quite a bit to change working condition and to get recognition for the strategies workers used to transform their own work. So that, for example, Catherine, who's my heroine, one of her first studies was of women who made gloves, and she discovered that they couldn't work past the age of 26. They were too old for the work when they were 26, and yet they were perceived as doing something that was a very simple task of, you know, sewing around the different fingers of the gloves. And so she investigated why so much skill and physical prowess was involved with producing these gloves. And when she did that, she realized that the cutters who cut the two halves of the gloves didn't do a perfect job, and so that the person who sewed the gloves had to be all the time thinking of how am I going to get these two slightly matching but not perfectly matching halves together, so that there was physical tension involved in holding the two halves of the glove just right so that you could get the seam done, and then a lot of intellectual prowess also involved in doing this task. And all this was unrecognized by the employers, and even to some degree by the workers themselves, so that when she published about this, it gave people a new way to look at the kind of repetitive work that people think is brainless and easy and is often done by women, and to think about the abilities and skills that are required and the physical demands that may be invisible. And we've taken that kind of work as our model and used it to try to get recognition for the kind of invisible work that women do in Quebec. And we've had a fair amount of success in changing various kinds of situations. So the one that comes immediately to mind is that we studied teachers, elementary school teachers' work with the teachers' union. And there, the question that was asked to us was, elementary school teachers have a really easy job. They just have to play with the little children all day, and then it's a really short work day, and then they go home, and they have summers off and lots of holidays. So why is it that the level of mental disabilities associated with work is highest among elementary school teachers of all the white-collar professions once they get to ages 35 or so, whereas it's the lowest of all professions when they start out, all of those white-collar professions when they start out. So how would that, how does that happen? And so we studied the various requirements of their jobs and the tremendous work speed. And one number we came up with was that the average length of a communication from a teacher is 6 seconds when they're in grade one and 14 seconds when they're in grade four. So that in grade one, they're speaking really quickly and in short bursts because the kid's attention span is really short and they have to get really simple ideas out. But it means that their work speed is actually quite fast because they have to do everything in these little short bursts. And when the kids get a little older, they can about double the length of their sentences, but it's still pretty short. So that was one way of illustrating the work speed. Or another was the fact that the average length of time that they look at any particular object in a classroom is 3 seconds. So with this observational technique, we were able to show then a really fast work speed and also some of the tremendous mental and emotional demands made on elementary school teachers that would explain why, in the conditions they were given to do these jobs, why they were becoming tense and upset. For example, we studied the temperature and humidity conditions in classrooms in where they were working, and none of them were within the required limits in the building standards code. So when we showed this, we were able to, those results were used for in two ways. One is they were used in Venezuela, because we had a Venezuelan student, to get class size lowered in one of the provinces in Venezuela. So in that way, it was useful. And in Quebec, they were used by the teachers' union to campaign against getting class sizes made larger, because the government was trying to make the class sizes larger. And they used our results to show that really people were at their limit. And it was successful in keeping this and stabilizing the class size. So in some ways, this showing the complexities and the hidden demands of women's work has been used successfully by the unions to protect women in some sense.
You're listening to an interview with Professor Karen Messing. Messing is co-founder of the Center for the Study of Biological Interactions Between Health and the Environment at the University of Quebec in Montreal. Her research focuses primarily on physical and psychological elements of women's work in jobs normally undervalued both by employers and by researchers, jobs that are also highly vulnerable to pay cuts and workload increases. She was just explaining how her work has been used to prevent increase of elementary school class sizes in Quebec. From there, we moved on to discussing women's shelter employees.
So, okay, so you've gotten to protection of the status quo, and of course, thinking as a feminist, my thought is, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice if the whole thing could be sort of reshaped? But I'm sure that must go through your mind many times a week working in this.
Well, there's two ways to go with that. One is to tell you about the request we got from the women's shelters, which I think I spoke to about, and that is one topic, and then the other is some of the social changes we've been trying to do. So,
okay, let's start talking about the women's shelters, and then we'll round out with the social changes. Yeah.
We got a request from the group of women's shelters in Quebec for a similar reason to the elementary school teachers. That is, the group of women's shelters discovered that they had a pretty high turnover, particularly among younger women, and also they had a level of stress. The shelter counselors were reporting a pretty high level of stress and wanted some help with that. So they asked us to do an ergonomic study, which we've been doing with a social work professor named Nancy Guberman and another ergonomist named Céline Chatigny and some students. And what we've done is 142 hours of observations in the women's shelters, and the idea is to improve this work while respecting feminist values. So the first thing that we found out in listening to the women, because we don't just observe, we talk also to the women, or we listen to the women, both individually in individual interviews and also in collective interviews and focus groups. So we learned that what was really, really important to the women working in the shelters was the feminist values of empowerment, solidarity among women, and equality among women, and that the reason they were happy with these jobs, and despite all the difficulties, everybody loved, well, not exactly everybody, but most of the women were very, very pleased to be in these jobs, was that they could work while furthering these ideals and while helping other women. So that when they became upset and frustrated, it was when they felt they couldn't be doing that to the extent that they wanted to. And when we did our original first 40 hours of observations, one of the things that appeared important to us and to them was the level of interruptions to their work. They felt that they couldn't concentrate to the extent that they wanted to on the time actually spent counseling the women in the shelters or women who phoned in. And they felt they were being interrupted when they were doing written work that they needed to do, like writing down little notes for other shelter workers, or just taking notes for the files on the cases, or making notes about what their plan was for the women. And they just to get a few minutes to concentrate on what they were doing was really, really hard, because when you're in a shelter, you're subject to demands from everywhere. There's all the women. There's their children who aren't necessarily, you know, they're often in crisis, and so they're not really behaving as well as they might, and they may be fighting with the other kids in the shelter. And then, they've also got to take care of the plumbing and the cooking and the deliveries, and then there might be a blue car going by, and they're wondering if that's the blue car that they saw a little while ago, and is somebody circling the block, and is it so-and-so's husband that they've been afraid he's found out where the shelter is. And so they've got a whole bunch of things going on at once that they have to furnish effort for. And in the middle of all this, they have to be able to concentrate, and it's really hard. And it's really hard also to get some 30 minutes or 45 minutes uninterrupted time with a shelter resident so that they can discuss with her, you know, her going to court and what she has to do there, or find out from her what was going on between her and her partner that made her end up in the shelter and so forth. And then there's the overriding security concerns also that are ever present and that sometimes interrupt the work. So we decided that our part of the study was going to be concerned with interruptions and how to minimize those. And the first thing we did was we counted up the interruptions. We said, if they're spending, and they are, 62% of their time doing the counseling and writing up the counseling, or reading other people's notes on the counseling, if 62% of their time is spent doing that function, then on the average, 62% of the interruption should come during that time as well. So we asked the question, what activities are interrupted in proportion to the time that they take, and what activities are interrupted more, what activities are interrupted less, and similarly, what activities are doing the interrupting. And when we did that, we found out that although the structured interviews, the kinds of interviews that where you can really work with a woman on what's going on with her, although they were interrupted somewhat less than chance would allow, they were still being interrupted too much, because it should never happen that a structured interview is interrupted. And they were interrupted often enough that the average uninterrupted time in an interview was about 10 minutes. And the median uninterrupted time, that is the about half the interviews, were interrupted after 2 minutes. So that was much, much too much. And so we were asking what was doing the interrupting. And that was an interesting question, because at the beginning of our study, one of the things that the group of shelters was using our work for was to get more money for the shelters. They were very starving for money. And our initial report, which was kind of an overview of the situation, was used by the shelters to try and get more money, and it was successful. I mean, they didn't just use our report, they used other techniques and other evidence, but they used our report, among other things, to get more money. And then, so they got enough money that they were able to work on a problem that the shelter workers had really put a high priority on, which was getting more than one person into the shelters at a time as the counselor. So if you only have one counselor and then you have all these demands, then the counselor's having a really hard time. If you have two women, one can be answering the telephone while the other one is doing the structured interviews. So out of our study, we contrasted the situation where there was one woman in the shelter being a counselor to the situation where there were two or more women in the shelter being a counselor. And then we found out something very interesting, which was there was just about no change in the number of interruptions. But there was a change in the activities that were interrupted. And when there were more than one woman doing the counseling at a time, then there were very few interruptions during the structured interviews, so that the women were able to prioritize what got interrupted. And the other thing that we noticed was that the source of interruptions were different when the shelter counselors were alone versus when they were working in pairs. And when they were working alone, it was the shelter residents that interrupted. And when they were working in pairs, it was their colleagues that were interrupting them. So the total numbers of interruptions were the same, but in the second case, they were being interrupted by their colleagues. And so we thought, well, what can we do about that? Why are the colleagues interrupting? Well, it turns out, you could guess this, being a shelter counselor is a really tough job, because you're dealing with violence. Violence is pretty tough. And we ourselves, when we went into these shelters and met the residents, you'll walk in and you'll have seven or eight residents, and one of them has a black eye, and one of them's crying, and one of them is just sitting in a corner. And so it's a heavy emotional burden to bear. And when you're doing these structured interviews, and we've sat in on some of them with the permission of the residents, and you hear some pretty terrible stories, and they're very upsetting. And we come out of them very shaken. So what happens is that the shelter counselors, after such an interview, they need to debrief. If they're alone, they can't do it, and they get upset. If they're working in pairs, they've got to go and talk to that other person and just get some reassurance about whether they're doing the right thing, or just doing debriefing, saying, oh, my God, you won't believe what she told me. And so our question was, well, how could this need, which is a real need and has to be met without interruptions? And so the kinds of things we're experimenting on right now with the women's shelters is it a good idea to have structured debriefing time rather than having it be interruptive? Couldn't it be scheduled a little bit more periodically? And so we're experimenting with that. Also, a lot of the communications between the shelter counselors, and particularly the more junior ones, the younger ones, have to do with, am I doing the right thing? And that turned out to be quite an interesting question, because there's no received science, there's no publicly accepted recognition for the kinds of feminist counseling these people do. They're thinking it up themselves. They're working it out themselves. They're discussing it in their feminist groups. If they're collectives, they're sharing their knowledge. But of course, it's not recognized necessarily by schools of social work and taught in recognized environments. And so there's a lot of uncertainty about what is the right thing to do when you're confronted with a woman who maybe is hesitating about going back to her partner who's been violent in the past. How can I work with this in a feminist way, using the values of empowerment and solidarity and equality? And it's not always clear. So one thing that Céline Chatigny, my ergonomics colleague, is doing is trying to figure out what is feminist knowledge about counseling, how has it been developed by the workers, and how can it be taught to other workers so that they will feel more confident about what they're doing, and therefore they may need less reassurance. So that, you know, on one level, we're looking at the immediate causes of the interruptions and trying to work on those, but on another level, we're looking at more distal, more further away causes and trying to work on those as well.
Wow. That is very interesting. You're telling me that there are women's shelters that have only one person as staff at that shelter day in and day out?
Yeah, unfortunately it still happens. I mean, the women's shelters are not rich places, and they're in Quebec, they're funded by the government to some extent, but they're funded at a pretty minimal level. Now, there's been recent increases in funding, and these have allowed some of the shelters to get more women. But the night shift, certainly, there's usually only one person. Sometimes there isn't anybody. You know, sometimes you can only staff during the day or staff during parts of the week.
And that's all for part one of my interview with Professor Karen Messing. Messing co-founded the Center for the Study of Biological Interactions Between Health and Environment at the University of Quebec in Montreal. Next week, we'll hear more of her analysis of women's work, including the curiously recalcitrant and debilitating practice of requiring women retail workers to stand.
We have actually got a judgment in Quebec that says that they should be sitting in Quebec, and they're still standing.
Messing works in a research partnership with three Quebec unions to come up with ways of improving women workers' health. She edited the Handbook on Integrating Gender in Ergonomic Analysis, published by the Technical Bureau of the European Trade Union Confederation. One of her works in English is the book One-Eyed Science, Occupation, Health, and Working Women, published by Temple University Press. For Wings, I'm Frieda Worden. The Solidarity Notes Labor Choir of Vancouver, BC, Canada. Bread and Roses. Words by James Oppenheim and music by Mimi and Richard Farina. Thanks to Kelly Ramirez for editing and research on this program. For Wings, I'm Frieda Worden, reporting. If you'd like to obtain a copy of this program, you can contact Wings. Our email is wings@wings.org. Our website, www.wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy and Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer, because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe. Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.